Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, one of the country's preeminent law scholars makes his case against the Supreme Court. Then we spend the rest of the hour discussing a disturbing trend of increasing numbers of school children being conditioned for the criminal justice system. What might it mean for society, and how should the situation be addressed? We are joined by Erwin Chemerinsky, Dean of the University of California at Irvine Law School and a distinguished constitutional scholar. Chemerinsky's latest book is called The Case Against the Supreme Court. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle, Erwin Chemerinsky. It is great to have you back here with us.
It's great to talk with you once again.
I am surprised and delighted about your book and about your disillusionment. What happened?
I realized that though I've been teaching constitutional law for 35 years, I've been making excuses for the Supreme Court. When I cover cases like Dred Scott versus Stanford, Plessy versus Ferguson, Korematsu versus the United States, I've been teaching them as if they're aberrations. And I realize that all too often through American history, the Supreme Court has failed, often in the most important times, in the most important ways. I've been very critical of the Supreme Court over all of this time. It occurred to me, somebody needs to write the book that says, you know, the Supreme Court has too often failed. We need to take steps to make the Supreme Court better.
You open with this case about a victim of eugenics, Carrie Buck. Who was she and why did you make her case the important one to make the case against the Supreme Court?
It's a case that people who went to law school have heard of, but usually it's just a footnote in constitutional law casebooks. But I've been surprised in speaking to audiences. Almost no non-lawyers have ever heard of this case. Carrie Buck was born in 1906 in Charlottesville, Virginia. She went through the sixth grade at the local public schools. She was always at grade level. By all accounts, she was a normal child. Her father left her mother. Her mother was destitute. They had no choice but to put Carrie and her siblings in foster homes. Carrie remained with her foster family, doing house chores and other work around the house. When Carrie was 17, she was raped by her foster father's nephew. Carrie became pregnant as a result of the rape. Her foster parents were humiliated by Carrie's pregnancy. They had Carrie institutionalized and was called a home for epileptics and the feeble-minded. Carrie gave birth to a daughter there. Virginia then began a proceeding to have a tubal ligation performed on Carrie, to have her involuntarily sterilized without her consent. An IQ test was given to Carrie. There's a primitive form of the test, and somebody testified that she had a low IQ. Many years later, Harvard professor Stephen Jay Gould found Carrie and gave her a modern IQ test, and Carrie had an IQ in the normal range. A social worker testified that she looked at Carrie's baby, who was then 6 months old, and the social worker said, quote, something doesn't seem right about the baby. It was ordered that Carrie be surgically sterilized. The case went all the way to the Supreme Court. This should have been an easy case for the Supreme Court. This was cruel and unusual punishment that the Constitution prohibits. Carrie, after all, did nothing wrong. The Supreme Court has long said that the word liberty in the Constitution protects fundamental aspects of family autonomy, including the right to procreate. But the Supreme Court, 8-1, ruled against Carrie Buck. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, one of the most revered of all Supreme Court justices, declared some of the most insensitive language, some of the most offensive language found in the United States reports, quote, three generations of imbeciles is enough. It's a horrific decision. 60,000 United States citizens were involuntarily surgically sterilized as a result of this decision in the eugenics movement. 60,000 people were denied their fundamental right to choose whether to have a child.
These are failures of societies as well as failures of the court, because the courts sometimes just conform to the norms of society. You say they are siding with the powerful. I agree. But it's a cultural element. Do you think that's part of it, or do you think it's just their sense of privilege and ideology?
Certainly, it's part of it. There was a eugenics movement in society. Many of the tragic Supreme Court decisions were the court going along. In Korematsu, the Supreme Court upholding the evacuation and internment of 110,000 Japanese Americans. That was the court going along. But I believe that the court exists to stop society when society is compromising our most fundamental values. There are also instances where society is trying to act more progressively, and it's the court that prevents that. When Congress adopted the first law that prohibited the use of child labor, it was the Supreme Court that declared it unconstitutional. Countless children were maimed or even killed because of that. Or to take a more recent example, a year ago, June, the Supreme Court declared unconstitutional key provisions of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. This is the first time since the 19th century that the Supreme Court declared unconstitutional a federal civil rights law dealing with race. There, society was doing something better, and the Supreme Court prevented it.
When we look at the course of history, even the founding documents of the Constitution itself, the founding fathers were not exactly the most democratic people. The original Constitution protected the slave owners and the slave trade. Where did this idea come from that the court should uphold the minority rights?
It's clear that the Constitution was in part about protecting minority rights. The framers would have thought of minorities as political minorities, as religious minorities. Today we would speak of racial and ethnic minorities, sexual orientation minorities. That's not what the framers were concerned about. But the framers knew that the majority rarely needs a constitution or the courts. The majority can do what it wants through the democratic process. It's minorities who need this protection. The framers were also aware from world history that in times of crisis, there's a tendency to centralize power, and there's a tendency to have our short-term passions cause us to lose sight of our long-term values.
And yet, they protected the slave owners.
There's no doubt that the Constitution protected the institution of slavery and slave owners. The South simply would not have accepted a Constitution that abolished slavery. I always ask my students, my college students, my law students, if they were Northerners who believed that slavery was morally abhorrent, would they have accepted the Constitution that protected it? Would they have been better off saying the North will have its own country and the South will have its country, but not to agree to a compromise that so clearly protected the institution of slavery?
Other areas of law that we've also seen, like the death penalty, the court has ruled very discriminatory.
Yes, the Supreme Court has made it very difficult to deal with the problem of race discrimination by government. The Supreme Court has said that the only way of challenging race discrimination under the Constitution is by proving that the government intentionally discriminated based on race. Just showing that this racially discriminatory impact isn't enough. To make that less abstract, I'll use your example, the death penalty. Statistics show, and they showed all over the country, that the death penalty is far more likely to be imposed for African-American or Latino offenders than for white offenders. The death penalty is much more likely to be imposed if it's a black killing a white person than if it's a white person killing a black or a Latino. And this came to the Supreme Court in 1987, and the Supreme Court 5-4 said, it doesn't matter what the statistics show. Proof of racially discriminatory impact of the death penalty does not demonstrate a denial of equal protection. There has to be proof that the legislature adopted the death penalty with the purpose of discriminating, or that this jury acted out of a discriminatory motive. And those are impossible hurdles to meet.
The court has also not always been great on the First Amendment, on issues of free press and free speech. People have been jailed for speaking out. There have been highlights where we've seen the court protect speech.
One general point I try to make in the book is that in times of crisis, the Supreme Court has not enforced the Constitution. I point to World War I cases that you mentioned. During World War I, Congress passed two statutes, one in 1917 and one in 1918, that made it a crime to criticize the draft in the war effort. You mentioned the case of Schenck. He circulated a leaflet in which he argued that the military draft was involuntary servitude in violation of the 13th Amendment. There wasn't the slightest indication that Schenck's leaflet had the slightest adverse effect on military recruitment or the war effort. Nonetheless, Schenck was convicted and sentenced to 10 years in prison. The Supreme Court upheld his conviction and his sentence in an opinion by Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. You mentioned Eugene Debs. He was a socialist leader. He gave a speech to an audience saying, quote, "You are good for more than cannon fodder. There's more that I'd like to say, but I can't." For that speech, he was sentenced to 10 years in prison. The Supreme Court upheld his conviction and his sentence. And this is a pattern through history where the court has not enforced the Constitution in times of crisis.
So it seems your argument is that the Warren Court is really the anomaly.
There's much to applaud about the Warren Court. Earl Warren became Chief Justice in 1954. He remained Chief Justice till 1969. It was the Warren Court that ended segregation, declaring that separate can never be equal. It was the Warren Court that expanded rights, like voting and privacy rights. It was the Warren Court that significantly increased the protections for criminal defendants under the Constitution. And yet, we have to realize that the Warren Court didn't do nearly as much as it should have and could have. Pick two examples where we all applaud the Warren Court. One is Brown versus Board of Education, which said that separate but equal has no place with regard to American public education. Yet look at American public schools today, how they're increasingly separate and unequal. I think the Supreme Court deserves a great deal of the blame for that. Or my other example is Gideon versus Wainwright. It was this landmark case that held that anyone facing a possible prison sentence has a right to an attorney in state court. Isn't it amazing that until 1963, a state could convict a person, even put the person in prison for life without an attorney? And yet today in the country, so many people are being tried for crimes, even capital crimes, with woefully inadequate lawyers.
And it seems to me that this is a pattern. There was an intentional effort to rein in the court. And since then, we've seen a lot of these things move increasingly back towards the corporate power, big government power against the individual. Now, let's fast forward to the more current courts. You specifically singled out the Bush versus Gore case. We know the result. What are the constitutional implications of that? And why did you single that one out?
To start with, I want to agree with what you said, that I think that this is very much a result of politicians in elections. Richard Nixon ran against the Warren Court when he ran for president in 1968, and when he was elected, he appointed four justices between 1969 and 1971 who dramatically changed the course of constitutional law. Ronald Reagan appointed very conservative justices like Antonin Scalia. George H.W. Bush put Clarence Thomas on the court. George W. Bush put John Roberts and Samuel Alito. They've given us the very conservative court that we have today. The reason I focus on Bush versus Gore is that I think it is one of the worst Supreme Court decisions in history. The Supreme Court invented a constitutional rule that's never been cited by the Supreme Court since, and the Supreme Court decided a matter that's clearly for the Florida courts, a question of Florida law, and made George W. Bush president. How different history would have been over the last 13 years if George W. Bush hadn't been president of the United States?
Like you've said, this is not necessarily a place that should insert itself, this political question.
Well, I think, if nothing else, the court got involved way too soon. What the Supreme Court said was that it's a denial of equal protection to treat similar ballots differently in the county. But there was no indication yet that similar ballots were being treated differently. The Florida Supreme Court on Friday, December 8th, 2000, sent the matter to a Superior Court judge, a trial court judge in Florida, Terry Lewis, and said, oversee the counting. And Lewis said, if there's any dispute, I'll resolve it. That seems to indicate that similar ballots would be treated the same. But the Supreme Court on Saturday, December 9th, ended the counting, and then on December 12th, the Supreme Court in Bush versus Gore decided the election by saying all counting in Florida had to stop. That meant that Bush would get the Florida electors. Al Gore conceded the next morning Wednesday, December 13th. Bush v. Gore was the first time that the Supreme Court decided a presidential election.
You're critical of some of the justices for stating in their confirmations that they were acting more like umpires in a game, where really what they're doing is deciding the terms of the game, like what the game itself is, essentially what the ballpark is going to be. And that affects how laws are made, what kinds of laws are made, and who gets to participate and in what way.
John Roberts, at his confirmation hearings in the summer of 2005, said, Supreme Court justices are just like umpires calling balls and strikes. Sonia Sotomayor, at her confirmation hearings in 2009, said, judges just apply the law, they don't make the law. John Roberts and Sonia Sotomayor should be ashamed of themselves for giving such a misleading sense of the judicial process to the American people. Supreme Court justices have tremendous discretion. How they exercise that discretion is a product of their views, their values, their life experience. What's an unreasonable search and seizure? Does the state have a compelling interest in saying that minors under 18 can't have access to violent video games? Does the state have a compelling interest in having diversity in the classroom and having affirmative action? All of these are value choices. Umpires aren't making value choices. And whatever the Supreme Court does makes the law.
When we look at them into the bigger picture, Citizens United is one that you also called out, I think rightly so. It essentially lays out the playing field, who can play, who can't play, who can have a voice. At the same time, limiting the power of unions while boosting the power of corporations in the decisions that they make also shapes the politics of the future.
Absolutely. In Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, the Supreme Court held that corporations can spend unlimited amounts of money from their corporate treasuries to get candidates elected or candidates defeated. This is having a devastating effect on our political system. We'll never know how many candidates chose not to run for office because of the corporate wealth that was going to be arrayed against them. We'll never know how many elections were decided, especially in small towns or in smaller states, just by corporate spending. Ironically, perversely at the same time, in other cases like Knox versus SEIU, in a more recent case in June of this year, Harris versus Quinn, the Supreme Court has very much limited the political power of unions. This court, the John Roberts Court, is systematically strengthening the political influence of corporations and weakening the political influence of unions. It's not coincidental.
It is also not upholding voting rights. So it seems like the entire ball game is being changed.
I think the ball game is being changed. I already mentioned with regard to voting rights, in June 2013, in Shelby County, Alabama versus Holder, the Supreme Court declared unconstitutional key provisions of the Voting Rights Act. But I'll give an even more recent example. The Supreme Court allowed a Texas law to go into effect even though a federal district court found it would keep 600,000 people from voting, almost all African Americans and Latinos. A federal district court judge held a 9-day trial and wrote a 143-page opinion about how the law had the purpose and the effect of discriminating against minority voters. Three federal judges had come to the same conclusion before the Voting Rights Act was struck down. The Supreme Court, 6-3, without a word of explanation, said the Texas law could go into effect for the November 4th election. At the very least, the Supreme Court should have explained to the American people why this judge's 143-page opinion was wrong.
You have some ideas for how to reform the Supreme Court. You think we need better ethics, more transparency, a different confirmation system. How do we approach this?
In the next to the last chapter of the book, I suggest many ways of reforming the court. Let's start by clearly defining the role of the court. Let's, as a society, say, and let's have the court say, that above all, the court exists to enforce the Constitution, to protect minorities, especially in times of crisis. I think we should go to a merit selection system for Supreme Court justices. I think we should have a much more meaningful confirmation process. I remember Senator Joe Biden saying to me at the time of the Samuel Alito hearings, that is all just an exercise in kabuki theater. We should have, I think, term limits for Supreme Court justices, 18-year non-renewable terms. Clarence Thomas was confirmed for the Supreme Court in 1991 when he was 43 years old. If he remains until he is 90, the age at which Justice Stevens retired, Clarence Thomas will be a justice for 47 years. It's too much power held by a single individual for too long a period of time. We should change the way the court communicates with the American people. I believe there should be cameras in every Supreme Court proceeding so the American people can see its government at work. The ethical rules that apply to federal district court and court of appeals judges must be applied to Supreme Court justices. No longer should be left to each justice to decide for himself or herself whether to be recused in a case.
Two areas that you didn't talk about is the number of justices. I've thought 9 justices was too few, given the population of the U.S. Do you think 9 is still okay?
I don't know how to determine what's the magic right number of Supreme Court justices. We got to 9 by a historical accident. When the Constitution was written, there's no specification in it of the number of justices. The first Judiciary Act in 1789 created 5 justices. Then, as the country expanded time, there was a new area. They appointed a new Supreme Court justice. So it got to 10 justices in the 1860s. Hard for us to imagine 10 justices and the possibility of ties. Andrew Johnson was a terribly unpopular president. He was from Tennessee, and he became president when Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. To keep Andrew Johnson from filling a vacancy, the Supreme Court was reduced from 10 to 9 justices, and it's been 9 ever since. Would 11 be better? Would 13 be better? Would 15 be better? As the court gets larger, there's certainly more inefficiency in terms of getting its work done. I also worry that when there's a Democratic president, a Democratic Senate, they increase the numbers. Then when there's a Republican president, Republican Senate, they'll increase the numbers, and there's no stopping point. So I shrug as 9. Nothing magical about it, but I don't know that 11, 13, 15, or 25 would be better.
To enforce the Constitution being the primary purpose of the Supreme Court, and yet it gave itself this power of judicial review to strike down laws early in its first court. It's not explicitly stated in the Constitution, and yet we've accepted it. Why do you continue to support judicial review itself, given it's not in the Constitution?
I've spent almost 40 years now representing individuals who realistically have no chance of success in the political process. I've represented inmates on death row who are facing death sentences. I've represented people who have been sentenced to life in prison for minor crimes like shoplifting. I've represented a Guantanamo detainee. I've represented a homeless man before the United States Supreme Court. I know for my clients, it's the courts or nothing. They may lose in the courts, but they're not going to win in the legislature. When's the last time any state legislature adopted a law to increase rights for criminal defendants? When's the last time a state legislature adopted a law to give more rights to prisoners? I think if the Constitution is going to be enforced, we need the courts. This is what Marbury versus Madison said in 1803. The limits of the Constitution have meaning only if they're enforced. We need the courts to be there to enforce the Constitution.
Erwin Chemerinsky, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you so much for having me. Great to talk with you.
Erwin Chemerinsky is the dean of the University of California at Irvine Law School. His latest book is called The Case Against the Supreme Court. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. We spend the rest of the hour discussing a disturbing trend of increasing numbers of schoolchildren being conditioned for the criminal justice system. What might it mean for society, and how should the situation be addressed? We turn now to Kim Socha, regional director for the organization Save the Kids, which works particularly with youth in the criminal justice system in mentoring, teaching, and helping them find new ways of engaging with others. Welcome, Kim Socha.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking about school children ending up in the justice system rather than in the schools. Do you have some sense of how large this problem is and how it's changed over time?
It is a problem that's really existed since school integration. And it's something that has only increased probably since the 80s in the war on drugs, when more individuals from urban communities were being convicted of drug-related crimes. And drugs, of course, had a very negative impact in inner cities throughout the United States as well. So it's at that time that there were, as the prison population started to grow, this, what is commonly referred to as the school-to-prison pipeline, was also established, where, let's say in certain situations, a child, if something happened at school and he or she got in trouble, it would be something that the administration of the school would take care of, maybe the parents would be called. But what began to happen was, and it's happening more and more, is police officers are called in, there's actually security on campus, and then that developed into metal detectors on campus and things such as that. And it started to ramp up very noticeably with the war on drugs in, let's say, the late 70s, early 1980s. I know that for the state where I currently live, and that's in Minnesota, about 40% of African-American youth aren't graduating from high school, and a very large percent of them are winding up in the criminal justice system in some way, either in juvenile detention facilities or headed to adult detention facilities.
The program that you're involved with, called Save the Kids, is trying to teach children how to use nonviolent methods.
There's a lot of organizations out there that are dealing with preventative issues, which is wonderful, and we support that and take part in that as well. But really, our main focus is on kids who are already in the juvenile justice system. So what we do is try to do some group building activity and work with them once they've already entered the criminal justice system. So we'll go into juvenile detention centers. I go in to the adult detention center in Hennepin County in Minnesota, which does house youth ages 16 to 18. So we'll work with them on afternoons as part of their school program. And then with the juvenile detention center of Hennepin County, and again, Save the Kids is national. I'm just talking about what I'm doing regionally. They'll kind of go in and do these activities and talk to the youth about what got them there, but try to also have play games and do fun things, offer different ideas and alternatives to acting out violently. And sometimes that can happen just through discussion. It can happen through a game of, you know, we have tons of games that we play, like a game of tag or something like that.
I noticed a number of the projects, one called HIP, Help Increase the Peace Project, several of them including a poetry project, workshops on bullying. Give us a sense of what some of these are.
HIP is actually a program of the American Friends Service Committee. So when we go in and hold the workshops, we use all of their different activities. And that could be anything from role-playing games to trying to keep a ball up in the air for a certain amount of hits and things like that, and setting up different games. What's unique to Save the Kids is we have a poetry journal called Poetry Behind the Walls. There's been about 4 or 5 issues that have been published, and it gives youth the opportunity to express themselves through artwork, poetry, narrative, rap lyrics, and to know that their work will actually be published and read by the community is often very exciting for them. And, you know, aside from that, it's simply just a way for them to be able to express themselves. And some of the most, I happen to be an English teacher, and some of the most, like, poignant and thought-provoking work comes from the minds of these. Legally, many of them are still considered children. Like, to look at it as these are not bad individuals. These are individuals who did one bad thing for reasons that are very complicated, and then there's social issues. And there's also a spoken word behind the walls, and that's something that is on hiatus right now, but we're trying to get started again, where youth have the opportunity to spit rhymes or read spoken word poetry, have it recorded, and then that CD becomes available. Just one other program is Wisdom Behind the Walls, in which adults who are incarcerated, some for life sentences, are trying to do meaningful work from the inside. So they will send us their poetry or their letters to youth, and we post it on a website so that even these men who can't reach the kids directly because they're incarcerated, they still have that opportunity to say something to them, which can be very powerful as well.
And philosophically, the kind of Q&A parts of the workshops I found kind of interesting, for example, questioning the morality of using violence to deal with violence.
Exactly.
What is the response to it, and have you noticed a meaningful change as a result of these kinds of conversations?
I mean, meaningful change is something that's, it can be very hard to gauge because what so often happens, for example, I'm working in the adult detention center, and a lot of these individuals are going to prison. So they're in jail and they're going to prison for long sentences. A lot of follow-up can't be done when that happens, but some of the conversations have most definitely were. Actually, we're also very interested in mentoring and following up. So it's not just, oh, we'll do some workshops while these individuals are incarcerated and then kind of let them go. We want to maintain connection with them once they leave. Quite a few of them have stayed in touch. Some have even gone on in the New York area to become mentors to other youth. And then sometimes kids who have been through the system, you know, have a little bit more credibility than, let's say, somebody like me who looks like the average teacher that they're used to, you know, dealing with and maybe who they had problems with when they were in school. We've also, in the Twin Cities, have something as simple as taking one of the individuals out to lunch or dinner and making ourselves available. We've had some good experiences in that people are staying in touch, and so I'm hoping that that continues and we can start to have those youth mentor other individuals as well.
Kim Sochev, Save the Kids, I think, might also get confused with Save the Children. So why don't you give us a website so people can check out your work on their own leisure time?
Let me just say that the organization itself was named by youth from Hillbrook Detention Center. So this idea of saving, you know, we don't believe we're saving anyone, we're helping, but one of the kids actually named the group. But the website is www.savethekidsgroup.org.
Thank you so much. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Children with behavioral problems are sometimes arrested, handcuffed, suspended, or expelled, which experts say merely exacerbates the problem. Simultaneously, many of these schools have been starved of educational resources. Daniel Lowson is with us. He is the director of the Center for Civil Rights Remedies, an initiative at the Civil Rights Project at UCLA. Also with us is Anthony Nocella. He's a visiting professor in the School of Education and senior fellow of the dispute resolution at Hamline University and Hamline Law School, respectively. And Damian Schneider joins us also. He is a professor of African studies at Scripps College. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us. I would like to start with Dan Lowson to try to understand this trend, how big it is, school kids landing into this justice system, and if you can quantify this.
A lot of people are unaware of just how many students are, for example, suspended out of school. And unfortunately, if you look nationally, kids who are suspended at least one time are over 3 million students. That's more than enough kids to fill every professional baseball and football stadium in America. And that is kids just suspended one or more times. It's not even getting at how many suspensions are meted out or how many days of lost instruction. And this is a real concern because we know that even being suspended one time doubles the risk of a kid not graduating on time. So there are tremendous negative academic repercussions, and then the racial disparities are just profound. So and also disability disparities, race and gender and disability. So for example, black students with disabilities, one out of every four, K through 12, were suspended at least once in 2009-10. So just a tremendous overuse. But the other piece of this is that there are many school districts across the country that are suspending very low numbers of kids, less than 3% of their total enrollment. So there is an alternative that is right there, that exists in many school districts across the country. So there are some that are suspending huge numbers and some that are suspending very few.
And so what you're saying is that the type of punishment, the suspension, is actually feeding the this pathway
exactly.
into...
I call it the school-to-prison pipeline. When you think about it, dropping out of school is one of the core predictors of whether kids will be involved in the juvenile justice system. Research report on Texas that tracked every middle school student in Texas for over 6 years found that being suspended just once dramatically increased the likelihood within a year that that student would be involved in the juvenile justice system. So that's one of the reasons we call it the school-to-prison pipeline, is because things like, you know, kicking kids out of school where they're left unsupervised is actually going to increase the risk of community crime, juvenile justice involvement, dropping out of school, all the things that we think we're trying to achieve by, you know, a lot of people say we're kicking the bad kids out so the good kids can learn. So their alternative is not just to leave kids who are disruptive in the classroom, but there are many, many alternatives that don't involve leaving kids unsupervised, that actually hold kids accountable and also bring more adults and kids together and pay attention and to try to really support the student, support the teachers, and find ways to keep that student in school and become successful.
Now, as I understand it, the suspension is just one of these kind of punishment models. I've read about things such as shackling kids and other kinds of extreme punishment that may also exacerbate that. Have you also looked at that?
Absolutely. And more what we're seeing is not only kids are being expelled, but in some districts I've looked at, we haven't looked at across the nation yet, but we are, it's increasingly common and often more likely than expulsion that a student is referred to law enforcement or arrested at school. So, for example, we have juvenile justices who have tried to work to push back against this and say to the school system, look, you're turning my courtroom into a principal's office. There are lots of offenses that should not be addressed by me, but really need to be taken care of by the principal. So part of the problem is that we have an infusion of more school resource officers, and many of them are not trained properly to work in an educational environment. They don't know anything about kids with disabilities. They don't know how to de-escalate situations. So they're taking sort of the beat policemen and putting them in a school without the proper training and without the proper coordination with educators. And it can be a real disaster. And that's where we've seen the worst situation. I think Judith Brown testified about this at the hearing that the Senate held in the Judiciary Committee, about a kindergarten girl who had a tantrum in her classroom, was brought into the principal's office where she still had a tantrum, but eventually she calmed down. The police officers were called for a kindergarten girl. She was sitting calmly when they entered the room, but what did they do? They handcuffed her, brought her out, put shackles on her, sat her in the police car until her parents arrived. That is the kind of excessive use of an entanglement with law enforcement. And that's just one of the thousands of examples we're seeing across the country.
Damon Schneider, let's bring you in. You look at cultural, intellectual, and physical elements that contribute to this problem.
One of the things that I try to look at is the rationale and the reasoning behind these various policies and curriculum changes that have taken place. And what I found is, for example, in Los Angeles County, is that as rates of suspensions have gone down, what's taken place is that schools themselves have been more turned into these sites of extreme enclosures, whereby students may not be suspended off campus, but are sent into particular rooms and literally do nothing at all throughout the course of the day. So my research goes back from the 1940s and 50s to the current period, and schools have been a primary site of resistance and organizing that groups such as the Black Panther Party use high schools such as Jefferson and Fremont as key sites. And so then school police and LAPD and the sheriffs were first put in place in these schools in order to try to make sure that these efforts of resistance did not take place by and large. And so what I'm finding, in fact, is that the technologies of control that are in place right now in prisons were first used in schools and then exported out to prisons as these sites of enclosure.
Anthony Nocella, let's bring you in. You've talked also about these five S's. What are they and how do they relate to this?
Going off of what Damian was noting, I think we have to look at two major facets and issues that many people, when discussing you know, the school-to-prison pipeline and issues around the school-to-prison pipeline don't like to discuss, which is racism and as well as poverty. And I think that has a great deal to do with the current prison industrial complex, which many people discuss, as well as Michelle Alexander's new book and a variety of other individuals have discussed that. And then poverty. And how do those two elements play into the rise of the school-to-prison pipeline? So I really want to get back to that issue and how complex the school system is not addressing that, be it in our curriculum, in our lesson plans, or just in how we construct the school and the community involvement within school. Who owns the school, and where are the teachers from, and what are the identities of these teachers? And I think that's really important as well. Going back to the five S's, I created a design, very simple for the students in the School of Education, to get an idea of what's going on today. And we're talking about the rise in overpopulation and overrepresentation of students of color, specifically African-American students, within special ed. The five S's are fairly simple. We're looking at special ed, stigmatization, segregation, and then we look at actual, you know, them getting arrested. And once we look at how these students are being pushed out, first being put into special ed and then put into segregation through that special ed, but how do they get into special ed? They need an IEP, which is individualized education programs. And an IEP is very hard to shake. I should know. I was in special ed from first to 12th grade, and then I was in segregated schools. And it was very difficult to feel confident about myself while I have this massive stigma of being different. And I think now not only are these students are oppressed because of their poverty or their race, but they're also now thinking differently, supposedly. And I think we need to address this problem, why so many teachers, which is predominantly white teachers in the United States, 97% of the teachers in Minnesota are white, 3% are teachers of color. And we have around 50% of the students graduating in the Twin Cities that are African American. This is an alarming rate that we need to address. So what is going on here? Are they leaving school? Or are they being pushed out? Are they, you know, getting kicked out? Are they leaving? Dropout versus push out concept. So I think these are some of the issues that we really need to talk about too.
All right. Well, let's bring Dan Lowson back in. You mentioned disability, and I didn't know if you were speaking of physical disability or if you're speaking of educational or learning disabilities. And now we've also been talking a little bit about special ed. Is this related?
Yeah. So what I was referring to are kids who are eligible for special education. So I agree with both the other two scholars that there is problems of racism and implicit bias. Oftentimes people think racism and they're saying, oh, you're accusing me of being like a Klan member. And I think what people fail to realize is that there's a whole range of racial bias where even people who would reject any concept of racism for themselves are still participating and they're not aware of it. So how they perceive, for example, behavior and whether or not they reach out to parents or give a kid a second chance can have everything to do with the race of the student and the race of the teacher. But I'd also point out that we have had principals like Joe Clark, African-American principal in East Patterson, who were notorious for trying to kick out all the bad kids in ways that were very not sound educationally. So one of the questions I think about structural racism as well, so where would we hire a person like a Joe Clark? I don't think you see principals like that being hired in the wealthier or whiter suburbs in America. Where do we tolerate that really harsh treatment of students, almost the criminalization of our youth? It's much more likely we'll hire leaders who have that sort of approach and attitude if they're working with racial minorities in urban settings than any other subgroup of the population.
Now, before we turn to looking at remedies and potential solutions to this problem, and it's very complex and very deep, unfortunately, we won't be able to get to everything, I wanted Damian Schneider to go back to you for a moment because of the aspects of the intellectual and cultural issues that have been coming up, for example, and they're embedded in the structure. So funding for particular kinds of music programs or funding for particular kinds of library books. You've researched this. What have you found?
If you go back to Nixon's administration in terms of being a president of the United States and his education policy of a nation at risk, which systematically tries to get rid of public education. That was his call for his campaign for president. From that point forward, what you see is a systemized process of testing, which manifests wholeheartedly in the Bush administration of No Child Left Behind, and has continued under the Obama administration, which links test scores and the charter schools. Now, what has happened is that a lot of money has been put in order for schools to be able to perform at a high rate with these tests, and as a result, a lot of the other school outlets, such as music or art, so on and so forth, in particular in schools which are not doing well, just happen to be black and brown schools as well, these programs have been completely cut out of the school altogether. And once again, going back to this aspect of being autonomous and having the ability to dictate what happens in your own schools, is largely tied to these forms of music, art, so on and so forth. And so when this process happens, of course, then the schools become more and more just forms of what I call pedagogical incapacitation, where literally nothing is going on, nothing is being taught, and the students just go there for the sake of having to go there. But all forms of resistance have been cut down as a result.
Well, let's turn now to how can a system, a society, address these issues where schools are thought ideally to be a place where students can develop their potential, where they develop a future for a society or a country or a state that is really hopeful and prosperous in all areas of human development. So how do we get from here to there? I think, Anthony, we've left you out for a little bit, so why don't we start with you? One of the things you talk about is this issue of transformative justice. How does that fit in here?
Well, I think we have to see throughout society that we're engaged in a culture that promotes and fosters discipline that is grounded and rooted in punitive and retributive measures. That goes with the teachers, the teacher assistants, the principals, police officers, our parents, etc. And we have to start figuring out transformative healing and transformative justice ways, which takes into consideration one's identity. So if we are at a mediation or a peer mediation, if it's in a school or in a community mediation, we're not just bringing two people together and calling one a victim and one an offender. While the offender might be a huge transnational corporation that is sucking jobs out of a small town, we have to address that issue as well. So maybe a 14-year-old kid graffitied on this wall of this corporation, but what's making this kid do that? Well, it might be that their parents are having to do 15 different jobs to make ends meet because their job that they had before this corporation came into their town or their city was actually paying them a decent living wage. So I think we have to really complicate things when we look at justice, and we also have to look at how these schools are structured with metal detectors within them. We have to take the metal detectors out. We have to take the security guards out. We have to take much of these retributive and punitive systems out if we really want education to occur. If we don't want education to occur and we want it to be repressive and we want to force kids into incarceration at an alarming rate since the 1990s to now, which is becoming very, very profitable in the private, the nonprofit, and the state sector with incarcerating kids or putting them in non-secure and secure facilities. Having worked in secure facilities and now working with youth and volunteering in secure facilities in the Twin Cities, I can see that about 97% of the kids that are incarcerated in Minneapolis or in Hennepin County are kids of color. There is a direct correlation on how we're treating kids in school versus the same kids that are being incarcerated. And in sum, I think we need a new justice system. It can't be reformed. It needs to be completely transformed or done away with. It's based on a very much slave and master narrative. And if we look at the 13th Amendment, we can see that. It's institutionalized slavery only when somebody has been convicted of a crime. So we have about 2.5 million slaves in the United States right now. And I think that needs to be addressed as well.
You know, I want to ask you for just a second, because of what happened in the East Coast with the shooting that occurred, in terms of the idea of metal detectors and those kinds of securities. Now, they had some like that at that school, and yet the kid that went and shot up the school forced his way in by shooting. how do you balance these issues? And I understand what you're saying is we need an entire transformation in the society, which I think everybody on this panel would agree with. But in the meantime, how do you protect six-year-olds?
This is Dan Lowson. It's often difficult when something like a school shooting like that or Columbine is the sort of driving force behind any change, because many of those things are difficult to prevent at the school security level. And it's really in that issue, and certainly in Columbine, you know, earlier intervention with supports for kids and mental health may or may not have helped. It's just a tragedy all around. And especially the fact that someone breaks into a school and kills all these children. It's just horrific. But I think on a daily basis, what we really need to think about is what the other folks have been talking about, is how we frame what we do around discipline, and discipline should be part of an educational mission and educational message. So the message has to be, we care about you, we want to improve your behavior, and not the personification, I would call, of our schools. Instead, we need to develop much more training for teachers to heavily engage with their students, have trusting relationships with them and their families, and that requires oftentimes a greater attention to multicultural differences and sensitivity. In schools, the research that is coming up will show that classroom management programs that really bolster and help teachers learn how to develop better trusting and engaged relationships with their students and their families actually not only reduce the use of out-of-school suspensions, but also reduce them more for kids of color. Research in Chicago suggests that the school climates serving kids from the most dangerous communities, usually racially and socioeconomically isolated neighborhoods, those schools, when they are strong on trust and engagement, they are as safe as the wealthiest schools in the Chicago area. So there's quite a bit to be said about developing more sense of trust and engagement and less of this sort of high security, turning our schools more and more into prisons.
What is the first step that we go towards this path?
So I would say training teachers and leaders and providing more supports for teachers and leaders in working with students and their families, and also bringing in things, systemic change and restorative practices, which comes off from Native American sort of philosophy where kids are held accountable but are absolutely important to keep them part of the community, and so that it's not punitive, but it's really looking at both the relationship of the student to the community, as well as improving or helping the student who has maybe done something that has violated the codes of conduct, and in a way that's supportive and constructive. So it's a much more rehabilitative kind of sensibility and much more inclusive, rather than this idea we're going to kick you out onto the streets where you're unsupervised. And those methods don't work. And economically, they make no sense whatsoever.
Damien Schneider.
In response to your previous question, I think there's three main things that could be done, have to be done, in order to change the system, just for the short term. The first is to get rid of testing.
You mean standardized testing?
Standardized testing, exactly. Exactly. That has to go. That has to be top of the agenda. The second is to get rid of all forms of formal and informal policing on campuses. And in many schools have many levels, tiers of policing. It could be a county sheriff, the city, the school district policing, and then staff members as well. All that has to go as well. And then the third thing is that there has to be understanding that there is lots of money within public education, but where that money is going has to be tracked and systematically changed as well, so that members of the school, neighborhood, and community have not only access, but have say as to where all of those funds are being spent, and then we'll be able to dictate what the school looks like with that money as well.
You know, I'm still struggling a little bit, given all the school shootings that are going on, with wanting to go past the policing and not have that in the future, but removing it right away before we've really transformed a society is a little bit frightening, I think, for a lot of parents.
I think the thing to understand is that once all these measures are put in place, it's found that schools actually are more dangerous. So it's counterintuitive to what you normally would think. So, for example, when the DARE program was first put in place here in Los Angeles, drug usage rates actually went up instead of going down within schools. In large part, it's going back to what members of the panel were saying, is that you have people who are not trained to work with youth are using very draconian measures, this automatic resistance against that in any form, way, shape, possible. So the moment that you put in these measures saying you can't do this, you can't do that, you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that, what you're going to have is resistance to that just naturally because you're telling youth that it can't do something and not explaining what it is at all. So there has to be a much more holistic approach which involves members of a neighborhood, members of the community to come and come up with solutions themselves as opposed to just imposing these very harsh norms upon schools.
Anthony, let's finish up with you. And in your final comments here, I'd like to hear a little bit about your experience with the Alternative to Violence Project and how that affected the youth you were working with.
Well, I would first say, before going to the AVP, Alternative to Violence Project, that started in Greenhaven Prison in the 1970s to eliminate some of the riots and unjust behavior that was going on by the prisons towards the insiders. It's conflict transformation, and some people from the outside and some people from the inside came together to develop group building and conflict transformation workshops to deal more constructively with different gangs, as well as between insiders, as well as meaning prisoners and correction officers, and how to develop a more constructive relationship. So there are programs in the community, and I think that would be number one. Get the community involved. Make sure that the schools, and I think, you know, hip-hop and hip-hop studies and hip-hop culture really speaks to that, is that until schools are teaching something that is useful for the kids, like surviving, like handling police brutality, like making sure your heat is on in the winter, those kind of issues, then school is really not important to a lot of youth, specifically in the urban community. And hip-hop speaks to that over and over again for the last 15 years. Yeah, almost every political album has spoken to that issue. So I would think that schools need to start addressing community needs, and then the school's only going to be able to address communities if the community's involved. And I think, as somebody recently said on this show, is that I think we need to start getting teachers and administrators and principals and superintendents involved in training. And I think the number one form of training is listening. They do a lot of talking, but they don't do a lot of listening to the community members and seeing what they need. And once they do that, I think that's where they need to start sharing the power of education and making sure that education is really multicultural. Right now, it's not. And I think it's only focusing on one dominant culture.
Well, Anthony Nutella, Dan Lowson, and Damian Schneider, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.